Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
Change the healthcare system.
Insurance coverage. Control these costs. $900 billion.
Abortion. Healthcare system.
Concern. 45 million Americans.
That's pretty cool, I guess.
Wait a minute!
I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this before.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
At least this much is clear from the Church's stance. Health care for all, exclude abortion, protect conscience rights.
That's all I had to say about that.
Come look at this fellow on the radio. He looks just like you.
I was told that I could listen to the radio at a reasonable volume.
You are correct.
All right, let's do it. Well, good afternoon. I thank you for being with me this hour. We have got, we're going to take on this question of Notre Dame again. And Father Jenkins, president of Notre Dame, has announced new pro-life initiatives. He's going to go to the March for Life now. He's appointing a task force on choice, making choices, good choices on abortion. And you have to ask yourself this question, what's Notre Dame been doing since Roe v. Wade? I mean, if I told you that the president of Ave Maria University, Nick Healy, was going to take a contingent of students up to the March for Life, you would say, well, that's not news. Or if I told you that the president of Christendom College was going to take a contingent of students to the March for Life, you wouldn't say that's news. You would wonder why anybody would think it was news. And so the question is, why does anybody think this is news? That Notre Dame's president is going to go attend March for Life in January. Now, this is a game is being played here, and it goes back to outrage, which was shown by many of you when Notre Dame decided to confer an honorary doctorate upon the president of the United States, who's a champion of abortion rights. It seemed outrageous then. It's outrageous now. And I think the president of Notre Dame is trying to do something to create pro-life bona fides here. We're going to talk with Professor Charles Rice. He is professor emeritus in the law school at the University of Notre Dame. And he's author of many books, 50 Questions on the Natural Law. Most recently, Professor Rice was with us talking about what happened to Notre Dame, and so I've asked him to come back and join us today on this. He's written an open letter to Father Jenkins on this question, and really, I'd almost like to just sit back and let Professor Rice do a dramatic reading of the letter, because that itself, we'll have the letter posted, but that itself would make the point. So we'll have the letter posted at AveMariaRadio.net, but Professor Rice is going to join me in just a few minutes. And Dave DeFranco will be with us as well, spokesman for ReplaceJenkins.com. He's a graduate of Notre Dame, 1995. And then we inaugurate a new series this week on Crest in the Afternoon, a Catholic view of the great literature of the West. Now, Ignatius Press has just released in the last year 10 volumes of literary classics under the general editorship of Joseph Pierce. Many of you know Joseph from his many books, Literary Converts, C.S. Lewis and the Catholic Church, Solzhenitsyn, A Soul in Exile, books on Tolkien, Hilaire Belloc, G.K. Chesterton, Shakespeare, Oscar Wilde. Joseph's a very fine fellow to have as general editor of this series. So we're going to look at these books through Catholic lenses. And we'll start this week with Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's 1816 book, which has been so influential in Western culture. So that's coming up in this hour. Next week, we'll do Shakespeare's Hamlet, and we'll see where we go from there. So that's what's coming up on this afternoon's Cresta. But first, to the headlines with Nick Tom.
Thank you very much, Al, and a good afternoon to everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News. It is Wednesday, September 23rd. The saint of the day is Saint Padre Pio. Today's news is brought to you in part by Ascension Press. Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi was sharply critical of the United Nations as he spoke before the UN General Assembly today in a speech that lasted well over an hour, 90 minutes in length. He said nations on the UN Security Council wield too much power. Through an interpreter, he said the answer is not expanding the membership of the council.
If we have more superpowers to the already superpowers that we already have, this will crush down the peoples of all small peoples, the third world countries.
He cited a litany of offenses, including the invasion of Panama and the involvement of the United States and other countries in Iraq and Afghanistan. He also decried numerous wars that have occurred since the foundation of the United Nations, an organization meant to prevent such wars from occurring. He even, in his rambling speech, brought up the assassination of JFK and tried to lay at least part of the blame on Israel. Senators are bogged down over the details in a sweeping health reform bill. Correspondent Terry Moore says tempers are getting short.
Mr. Chairman,
senators on the Finance Committee are poring over hundreds of amendments to a bill by Montana Democrat Max Baucus, the committee chairman. In day two of deliberations, Republicans continued efforts to slow the process down, accusing Democrats of rushing things along. Baucus got into a procedural spat with Arizona Republican John Kyle.
Mr. Chairman, point of personal...
debated, the amendment is not germane.
Is that a debatable motion?
Amendment is out of order.
Democrats accuse Republicans of delay tactics as the haggling continues. I'm Terry Moore on Capitol Hill.
A new volume of the early works of Joseph Smith's papers are now made available by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Church officials said the second volume was released Tuesday, coinciding with the anniversary of Joseph Smith's allegedly receiving the ancient plates that later became the Book of Mormon. Assistant Church historian Richard Turley says now the public has the earliest copy of the Revelations available to them.
Well, with the publication today of this set of manuscript revelations books, we can make available to the public now the earliest copy of that revelation.
Along with the aged and faded handwritten alleged revelations, some composed by Joseph Smith himself, are written transcripts, historical content, and revisions. It will retail for $100. And the federal investigation into an alleged bombing plot in New York City prompted counterterrorism officials to warn mass transit agencies across the nation to step up awareness efforts and patrols. Washington, D.C.'s Metro Transit System was on that list of agencies alerted, but a Metro spokesman says there's no reason for passengers to be alarmed. Passengers like this say they're not.
I don't want to, get to, too wound up about it, because it's going to happen, You just can't walk around, paranoid or whatever, worrying about them. It's going to happen.
Metro spokesman Steve Taub says they are not doing anything different than what they have been doing since September 11th, 2001. He went on to say that police and security personnel are constantly working to protect the transit system, adding that passengers will not likely see any visible security increase on trains and inside Metro Rail stations. And now your fascinating fact for the day. The planet Mercury orbits the Sun approximately once every 88 days. Reporting for Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Nick Tom.
Afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. The president of Notre Dame, Jenkins, Father Jenkins, has announced last week that he'd be appointing a task force on supporting the choice for life, that he would be leaving a group of Notre Dame students to the March for Life next year. And, all the help, all help on this issue is welcome. The question that went through a lot of people's minds was, we would have thought Notre Dame already had very active pro-life groups going to the March for Life or working on campus or being involved in activism. What makes this news from Father Jenkins? With me right now to discuss Father Jenkins' announcement and to discuss his own open letter to Father Jenkins is Professor Charles Rice, Professor Emeritus in the Law School at the University of Notre Dame, founding member and legal counsel of the New York Conservative Party, author of many books, including 50 Questions on the Natural Law and What Happened at Notre Dame, which we discussed just a few weeks ago. Also joining me in this segment will be David DeFranco, spokesman for ReplaceJenkins.com, a graduate of Notre Dame, 1995. Professor Rice, how are you?
Oh, fine. It's a pleasure to be on the program again.
I very much appreciated your open letter to Father Jenkins, and I thought it was very gracious, and I think it's right to express appreciation. At the same time, I have to confess, when this announcement came out, I was surprised. I was surprised because I would have thought that Notre Dame and its various student groups would have already been pretty deeply involved in the pro-life movement. And I'm not sure what Father Jenkins' announcement is meant to achieve.
Well, the involvement of Notre Dame in, for example, the March for Life and other Right to Life things has always been on the part of the students, with the support of campus ministry, but not an institutional involvement.
Okay.
The students have gone to the March for Life every year since it began, but there never has been an institutional representation of Notre Dame as such. And that is what Father Jenkins is proposing here. He says, well, I'm going to go to the March for Life, and I hope to have a Notre Dame mass down there and all the rest of it. And the problem is that's one of his proposals. Another is to set up the task force on supporting the Choice for Life. And as Bill Dempsey, the head of the Sycamore Trust, which is an alumni group at Notre Dame, has pointed out, this task force doesn't include anybody from the Center for Ethics and Culture and the ND Fund for the Protection of Human Life. It doesn't include anybody from any students from the Right to Life organization. And it doesn't include anybody from the ND Response Group, which formulated the very constructive response to the Obama invitation. So Bill Dempsey put it on the line. He said you have to regard it with suspicion because of that. And the other aspect of it is that going to the Right to Life is really, I mean, for Notre Dame to, at this point, present an institutional representation at the Right to Life for Father Jenkins to go there and be an advocate for life is, in my opinion, grotesque because Notre Dame is still pursuing the criminal process against the 88 people who were arrested at Notre Dame because they wanted to go on the campus, which is ordinarily an open campus,
right,
and pray. So I mean, the whole thing is very, very strange. And the last thing that he stated in his statement was that he urged Notre Dame people and clubs to support the Women's Care Center and similar entities. And the suggestion I made was, well, wait a minute, there. From the beginning of the Women's Care Center, one of the proposals was that there be an office on the campus at Notre Dame. And I think that's what ought to be done, a standing invitation to the Women's Care Center to come on the campus and offer their very splendid services to the Notre Dame community on the campus.
Have they? Has Notre Dame refused them in the past?
No, the issue is they've never invited them.
Okay.
There's never been a point of contention. It's just been one of those things, hey, wouldn't it be great if we had that kind of thing, you know.
I want to hear about these this continued pursuit of trespass charges. I'm sure one of the things he says is, well, it's Notre Dame's not pursuing trespass charges. These are the state is pursuing this.
That's true, and that's what his claim is. That's what Notre Dame's claim is. And Fred Fredoso, who incidentally wrote the introduction to that book, What Happened to Notre Dame.
Yes, very good.
The introduction is better than the book. but Fred sent an email to Father Jenkins asking him to request the prosecutor to drop the charges. And Fred got back a reply from Father Jenkins' chief of staff and special assistant, saying that Father Jenkins had a hectic schedule, and so she was replying. And basically the point was that what she said was that these people were just prosecuted not for speech but for trespass, and that is just nonsense because this is not an ordinary trespass to land case. A trespass case would be the kind of thing that would arise where you've got a house on a corner and commuters cut across your lawn and your flower bed to get to the train station. That's trespass. Right?
Mm-hmm.
These Notre Dame's campus is ordinarily open, and you had Notre Dame response, which, and you have to give the university great credit for this, was the university permitted the opponents of the Obama coronation, as it were, to hold an outdoor mass and rally and so forth on the South Quad. Well, you have other people who whose interest was in just going on the campus to pray the rosary, and that's what was involved there with, for example, Father Norman Westland.
Mm-hmm.
And the university could have forestalled that by meeting with these people and arranging for a place for them to be. I mean, why couldn't they go on the campus and pray the rosary? Father Westland was handcuffed by the Notre Dame security police.
79 years old.
Yeah, yeah. And he's a former paratrooper, a retired lieutenant colonel in the 82nd Airborne. And just a hero. He was singing Immaculate Mary as the Notre Dame police put the cuffs on him, and then they put him on a pallet and dragged him away, and he's in very poor health. So the whole thing was totally, in my opinion, it may well be the worst moment in the history of Notre Dame. But Father Jenkins credit. He, in his statement, he asked for a constructive dialogue, and I think that's good. I think it's about time we started talking about these things in very blunt terms. And it goes back to Lando Lakes, where Notre Dame 4 decades ago declared its independence from the church. And it's not just Notre Dame, it's all of the major Catholic universities.
Yeah. So this is, do you think we've got a watershed moment?
In what respect?
That we're going to see big changes in the future? That this dialogue would be fruitful?
No, well, it depends. I mean, Bill Dempsey, who is a very prominent lawyer and the head of the Sycamore Trust, which is the Project Sycamore, the alumni group, emphasized, as he has all along, the necessity of hiring Catholic faculty. And Bill, in his statement on this, which was a very, very good statement, he said, look, one of the disturbing things about Father Jenkins' announcement of all his pro-life initiatives is that it came the day after his address to the faculty, in which he called for an increase in hiring of women and minorities and said not one word about increasing the percentage of Catholic faculty, where the mission statement requires that it be a predominant number.
Yeah.
And he's right on that. As long as the university is operating here at this point, Catholic faculty of only 54%, including everybody who checks the box, and it's declining because the retirements are predominantly Catholic. As long as that's happening, what you have is what Fred Fredoso, in the introduction, very astutely described as a public school in a Catholic neighborhood, because Notre Dame has so many good things about it. And it's a place where a student can live the faith, but the academic side of it, the school side of it, is rocketing toward oblivion in terms of its Catholicity.
Well, let's see. We were supposed to have David DeFranco with us, too, today. Nick, is David still with us? David is spokesman for ReplaceJenkins.com and graduate of Notre Dame Class of 95. David, it's good to have you back. Thanks.
Thank you, Al. It's a pleasure to be on your program. And if I may address Professor Rice and just say that I feel privileged to be sharing an interview with him. I'm two-thirds roughly through his book, What Happened to Notre Dame. And for your listeners, I strongly encourage them to get a copy. It's a very enlightening work. Thank you, Professor, for writing that.
That's Thank you, David. You said that exactly the way I wrote it out for you.
Well, I mean it sincerely.
David, tell me about the ReplaceJenkins.com site.
Well, what we did in the response to the recent letter that Father Jenkins set out is just sort of express our reactions to those who are on our list. You know, as the name of our endeavor indicates, ReplaceJenkins.com, what we're looking for is a change in leadership at Notre Dame. It's a little more abrasive than some of the other alumni organizations, perhaps. But I think Jenkins, it seems every time he speaks or uses his pen, he does a lot of our work for us. What we've done is basically said, as you indicated, Al, at the introduction to this segment, is that if you look at what's included in his letter in isolation, it's all very good. I mean that the president of the University of Notre Dame would go to the March for Life is good.
Sure.
And that he would establish a task force that's looking to bring clarity and action in a campaign against abortion is good. Unfortunately, the letter is not received in isolation. It's received in context. And in context, it creates perhaps more questions than answers. And what we did, Al, is list four of them. And if I may, very briefly, list them, I think it helps sort of explain what many of the alumni are feeling in response to this letter.
We've only got about 60 seconds.
I'll be very quick, then. Okay. I'll get through as many as I can. The first one is what's juxtaposed, Father Jenkins going to March for Life when those who did it on our campus were arrested. The second question concerns why now? With all the opportunity that has existed over the last few decades, why does pro-life ambition exist suddenly now? The third question, Al, is why protest outside the White House at all? Father Jenkins promised us dialogue. He said that a bilateral conversation would exist with the president. Why can't he discuss this with him directly?
David, thank you so much. And Professor Rice, thank you. We'll come back as this situation develops.
Thank you, Al.
Thank you, Al.
Right.
Professor Charles Rice is Professor Emeritus in the Law School at the University of Notre Dame, author of What Happened to Notre Dame, and David DeFranco, a spokesman for ReplaceJenkins.com.
Hello, this is Steve Ray, and this is another Pilgrimage Minute. God told Moses to remove his sandals from his feet, for the place where he stood was holy ground. What is holy ground? Moses was a shepherd in a harsh wilderness. There were no church steeples rising into the sky. God called him from the burning bush, telling him that he was standing on holy ground. What made the dusty ground holy? The footprints of God had touched this ground, and God is holy, and he sanctifies everything he touches. Israel is called the Holy Land, where God walked. The first time I arrived in Israel, I wept and kissed the ground, thanking God for the blessing of being there. Pilgrimages are sandal-removing experiences where God touches us in space and time. Seek God and take a pilgrimage, even if it's just to your local Catholic church, for this too is holy ground.
More information on taking a pilgrimage can be found at AveMariaRadio.net and find the Holy Land link at the bottom of the page.
Great schools are places where ideas come alive and get everyone involved. This is what Ave Maria University offers. Come and experience the fruits of a true liberal arts education at Ave Maria University. Unlike schools who take the faith for granted, the faith is the lifeblood of who we are. Ave Maria University, preparing students for success in this world and for never-ending joy in the next. Call 877-AVEU-NIV or click www.avemaria.edu.
At Ann Arbor State Bank, we share the Ann Arbor state of mind with you. We're the entrepreneurs with money to lend and the will to lend it. What does this mean to you, an area business owner? It means we welcome you with enthusiasm and ease of lending. It means our seasoned business bankers are proud to be your banker. That's Ann Arbor, and that's the Ann Arbor State Bank, financiers of the Ann Arbor state of mind. Located at 125 East William or A2SB.com. Member FDIC, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Joining me right now is Joseph Pierce, who is the general editor of the new series, the Ignatius Critical Editions, which is a tradition-oriented look at some of the great classics of world literature. Today we initiate a 10-part series looking at some of these great classics, beginning with Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Joseph, who's been a frequent guest here on Crest in the Afternoon, is the author of numerous acclaimed biographies of major Christian literary figures. He's writer-in-residence and professor of literature at Ave Maria University in Florida, and he is co-editor of the St. Austin Review, an international review of Christian culture, literature, and ideas, published in England and in the United States. His latest book is The Quest for Shakespeare. And, Joseph, it's great to have you back. Thanks.
It's good to be back.
Well, let's take a look. Mary Shelley is a very unusual young woman. And as you point out in your introduction to Frankenstein, we need a series like this because volumes like the Norton Critical Edition of Frankenstein describes Mary as being irritated by the torments of conventional family values. And, of course, this then becomes a lens through which they interpret her novel Frankenstein, when, in fact, Mary Shelley is hardly the product of conventional family values.
Exactly. And in actual fact, the novel would be far more accurately and objectively read by seeing it as a creed de coeur, as a cry from the heart for those very conventional family values that she'd been denied. Because,
exactly.
Her upbringing was far from conventional, and it made her very unhappy, and actually was not only self-destructive, but destroyed the lives of several others, literally, in some cases.
Give people some idea of how unusual her upbringing was.
Well, again, the whole statement that she was rebelling against conventional family values can be seen to be nonsense when we see the fact that her father was a philosopher who actually was an atheist who believed that marriage was evil and should be got rid of. Her mother was one of the first feminist writers who wrote a book on feminism. She died shortly after Mary was born of childbirth complications. Thereafter, her father, who didn't believe in marriage and nonetheless remarried, Mary Shelley had a family which included a stepbrother, a stepsister, and a half-sister by her mother, who had an affair with someone else. So this is hardly a conventional family by any sort of Christian or traditional understanding of that word.
In structure or in idea, you know? I mean,
exactly. The philosophy was antagonistic towards the family, yeah. And the practice obviously led to a very unconventional family situation.
About 15 years old, she meets Percy Bysshe Shelley for the first time. Who's he?
Well, he is one of the leading romantic poets. He was also an iconoclast. He was an atheist, one who believed that the poets needed to serve the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age, and should spurn tradition. He sympathized with the figure of Satan in Milton's Paradise Lost. And he was, when he first met Mary Shelley, was married with a wife and a child and a second child on the way for the wife. And nonetheless, deserting his pregnant wife and child, he eloped with the teenage Mary Shelley, who very soon also became pregnant. So that basically both his wife and his lover were both pregnant by him at the same time.
Mm. what leads her to become an author?
Well, actually, there's an interesting story about it. They're at Lord Byron's house in Switzerland, and it's gone down in literary legend. There was a thunderstorm, and they all started telling ghost stories. And Byron sort of issued a challenge that each of them should try to tell some macabre story. And Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is the result of that challenge. And the fact that she was only 17 and 18 years old when she was writing it, she wrote it over a period of 11 months. Is really astonishing, because although it may not be a perfect work of literature, and for someone that age, it really is astonishing.
She begins writing Frankenstein in June of 1816. She's writing. What's going on in her life at the time that she's writing it, and do the events in her life seep through into the novel itself?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, you know, Oscar Wilde famously said that life follows art. I don't know if I agree with that, but certainly in this case, we certainly see that the art and the life being interwoven and intertwined almost inextricably. For instance, the story of Mary's life at this stage is as macabre and as deadly in some ways as the novel. For instance, during the 11-month period that she's writing the novel, her half-sister commits suicide. Percy Shelley's wife, for whom Percy Shelley deserted for Mary, commits suicide, drowns herself in the Serpentine in London's Hyde Park. I think it's during that 11-month period as well that Mary herself loses a child, if not, it's shortly before she starts writing it. So all of this is going on in the background. If you like, the culture of death playing itself out self-destructively with suicide and desertion and betrayal and all of that's going on in Mary Shelley's real life. And, of course, that maelstrom psychologically, emotionally, philosophically plays itself out in her imagination through the novel of Frankenstein.
Let's go to a brief synopsis of the novel, because many people still make the mistake of thinking that Frankenstein is the name of the monster.
Right. In fact, well, he could argue that he is.
Frankenstein is a monster.
Exactly.
Yes.
Frankenstein refers not to the monster. The monster is just referred to as the monster throughout. That doesn't have a name. He is nameless. Frankenstein is Dr. Victor Frankenstein, who is the scientist who creates the monster. But, of course, it could be argued that his very act of creativity is a monstrous act. It's an act of scientism, the worship of science above morals and ethics, and it's also can be played out on a more moral or spiritual level as man, the fundamental pride of man, making himself God. So Victor Frankenstein repeating the sin of both Satan and Adam and Eve.
So this takes place at a time in the history of science where there's this robust optimism about progress, about science and technology's ability to harness the forces of nature. Is overpromise in the air?
Yeah, well, I think that basically, in many respects, well, one of the wonderful things and powerful things about great literature is its perennial relevance. And this whole question of the relationship between man, human society, and science and progress is something which is obviously as much a central fact of our lives today in the early 21st century as it was in the early 19th century, 200 years ago. So what we see, in fact, is a clash. You know, on the one hand, you have this new sense of scientific optimism born from the Enlightenment, the worship of the future, which we actually see embodied in some of Percy Shelley's writing. And against that, we have the reaction against this progress. You know, the Industrial Revolution was new at this time and had already caused the defacing of the English landscape in what the romantic poet William Blake called the building of dark satanic mills. So you have this romantic reaction against progress as well. So this battlefield of if you like, scientific optimism and anti-scientific skepticism or anti-technological skepticism, is that battlefield is being played out in the novel.
Mary Shelley is a skeptic?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one of the interesting things about the novel, is that she seems to completely contradict the views of her husband, Percy Shelley, because the novel quite clearly looks at the way that science is going and technology is going and is horrified by it, and basically clearly thinking that scientists are beginning to usurp areas that are the rightful domain of God alone. And, of course, again, that's something which speaks very powerfully to our own age and the culture of death and eugenics and euthanasia and abortion and everything we have around us today. So, morally speaking, Frankenstein is almost a parable that's applicable to our own age.
Come back let's talk about Frankenstein, the modern Prometheus. On the other side of the break, my guest, Joseph Pierce, is the general editor of the Ignatius Critical Editions. They are bringing forth some of the great books of world literature. We're looking at Frankenstein by Mary Shelley.
The 12th Call to Holiness Conference takes place at the Shrine of the Little Flower in Royal Oak, Saturday, October 10th. The purpose of this conference is to reach all Catholics, to present and to teach about the great treasure that we Catholics possess, the Holy Mass. Often people come to Mass without truly understanding what is going on. Speakers like Father Edouard Perron intends to have a priest play act the Mass while he will explain each gesture, each prayer, while Father Michael Foley will explain how the Mass shaped the Western world. At this time, when Pope Benedict declares the year for priests, this conference will just underscore the true role of the priest. Pope Benedict is more and more emphasizing the infinite value of the Mass and how we, as Catholics, need to be disposed to receive Jesus in the Eucharist. Following our Holy Father's lead, the theme for this year's Call to Holiness Conference is Treasures of the Mass. To register, go to calltoholiness.com or call 586-247-1497. That's 586-247-1497.
If you had a choice, would you want to live till you're 80 or 40? Well, what about your car? 10 years or just 5 years? We can't control when we die, but you're likely to double the life of your vehicle when you get regular maintenance at Fauzi's Auto Repair.
Maintenance, it's a must. Power steering, brake, transmission. That's the last thing on their mind, is changing these fluid. It's forgotten.
For example, failing to flush your engine coolant can clog the heater core. This not only can result in having no heat in the winter, but eventually produces mechanical failure.
You know, most failure is basically neglect.
Why spend thousands of dollars on mechanical failures when a small fraction can greatly extend the life of your vehicle? Go to Fauzi's Auto Repair today to see what you could potentially save in just 5 years. Call Fauzi today at 734-665-8700. Mention you're a WDEO listener for a discount. That's 734-665-8700. Fauzi's Auto Repair. It's your car, their reputation.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Joining me, Joseph Pierce. He is the general editor of the Ignatius Critical Editions. We're taking a look at the great books of world literature. This is our first in a 10-week series. We're looking at Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. The alternative title was The Modern Prometheus, and she also couples that with an epigraph conveying Adam's complaint from Paradise Lost. And Joseph writes in his general introduction, here we see the leitmotif established concerning the relationship between creator, creature, and creativity. So let's unpack that a little bit, Joseph. Go ahead.
Well, basically, what Mary Shelley does is play with both Milton's Paradise Lost and God's creation of Adam and Eve in that work. And we have to distinguish between Milton's religion, which is very unorthodox, even you know, from a Protestant or a Catholic standpoint,
right.
And real Christianity. But she's reacting and responding to Milton's epic about God and the creation of man and man's response, and also, of course, of the classic myth of Prometheus, who rebels against the gods to create man. So the question is about legitimacy and creativity, about the relationship between God and man, between creator and creature. And it's quite clear, again, from Mary Shelley's work, that Victor Frankenstein's crime or sin is in usurping the power over life and death, and rebelling against a conventional understanding of Christianity, that basically God is the author of life and that we are creatures beholden to him. And it's clear from her novel that the Victor Frankenstein is the Promethean figure who rebels against God and in defiance of God creates his own man.
And then this monster man that he's created, who's left unnamed, how does he regard his own creation, his own existence in the world, and his own creator?
Well, again, he regards his own creation with horror. And this is, of course, one of the things that Mary Shelley's bringing out to us, that whereas God creates legitimately, because he's the only one who has the legitimate right to do so, man and the rest of the cosmos, and beholds that it is good.
Mm-hmm.
When Victor Frankenstein looks at his creature, his monster, as it comes to life, he is horrified by it, looks upon it and sees it as an object of horror.
So he calls it bad.
Exactly. But basically, his act is intrinsically evil, and of course the consequences of the act is destruction, ultimately the self-destruction of Victor Frankenstein himself, the misery of the creature he's created, the destruction of those who Victor Frankenstein loves, including his wife. All of this is the direct consequence of his evil action.
Let's talk about Victor Frankenstein's wife, Elizabeth. Dedicated to God, the name means. What? How is she portrayed?
Well, again, it really beggars belief that there's so many modern critics out there that keep insisting that Mary Shelley's work is somehow a feminist work. I mean, it's only a feminist work if we're going to say that motherhood and marriage and the feminine, as understood conventionally by Christians and by tradition, is upheld, because those sort of feminine values are certainly upheld, but not anything which we would understand as feminist. For instance, you know, Elizabeth throughout the whole novel is someone who is conventional in her morality. She tries to persuade Victor Frankenstein to give up his morbid passions and to take up a healthy lifestyle of farming and get married to her, have children. And, of course, he comes to realize that she's right, and if he'd listened to her earlier, then this self-destructive path could have been avoided. But in the end, she, the feminine figure, the wife, is herself sacrificed basically on the altar of Victor Frankenstein's sin.
Does she function in the novel as the voice of sanity?
Oh, absolutely. Basically, the two counts in the novel that are portrayed sympathetically are Victor Frankenstein's friend Clerval and Elizabeth. And again, throughout the whole novel, both of them are first of all, treated with absolute sympathy by the author. In other words, the authorial voice is indicating that these are the good guys,
yeah,
and the ones,
yeah,
and the ones that are the voice of sanity. And the things that Elizabeth does and says, always acting with love and decorum in everything she does. She reminds me, in fact, in many ways of a Jane Austen heroine. You know.
Yeah.
She's always doing the right thing. She's always doing the sensible thing and the virtuous thing. And Clerval also, as someone whose philosophy is very tradition oriented, very romantic in the neo medieval best sense of the word. So in other words, the two positive characters, the two characters that are portrayed positively by Mary Shelley, are both very conventional and traditional in their morality.
They're both Christians.
Yes, they're absolutely both Christians. And again, we see examples, for instance, how Percy Shelley edited Mary Shelley's original manuscript to take out the Christian elements, removing words like God and putting in words like mechanism or force.
Maybe Frankenstein is a feminist work in the sense that Mary Shelley is declaring herself liberated from the baleful influence of Percy Shelley.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Now, the monster in Frankenstein, he has self-consciousness, is that right?
Oh, yes, he does have self-consciousness, and he's trying to make sense of the situation that he's in. He reminds us of sort of Rousseau's noble savage, who sort of starts off intrinsically good and is made evil by his environment. Mm. And we have to remember that Mary Shelley is soaking up the various philosophical and cultural influences that are on her. She's rejecting and reacting against many of them. And I should add, by the way, that it is a feminist work, not merely in Mary Shelley liberating herself from her atheistic husband, but also liberating herself from the atheism of her father and the feminism of her mother, and the destructive self-indulgence of her own love affairs. Mm. I wanted to add that.
Well, but her father's life was changed by Rousseau's.
Absolutely. Both her father and her mother considered Rousseau one of the most important intellectual figures of all time.
That's interesting.
And of course, Rousseau denied the existence of original sin, believed that we were all basically created good, and it's only the evil of our environment that makes us bad. And therefore, of course, the danger of this is that we try to build a utopian, perfect society on Earth in the belief that if we did that, everybody would start acting in a virtuous manner.
And this
spawned the French Revolution and the Great Terror that followed that, and similar notions of, Rousseauian notions were behind the idea of communism. So it's responsible. I mean, Chesterton was very big on basically talking about how philosophies are far more deadly than serial killers.
My guest is Joseph Pierce, general editor of the Ignatius Critical Editions series. We're taking a look at, over the next 10 weeks, we'll be taking a look at some of the books in the series. We're looking today at Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. She began writing it in 1816. And I think it was published 2 years later, 1818. There's also an 1832 edition. Is it very different than the original edition?
No, it's not very different, but it's sort of, most critics believe, and I actually agree with the critics in this one, that the attempts by the somewhat older Mary Shelley to improve her work really sort of takes away some of the sharpness of it,
yeah,
and the rawness of it, really. I mean, it's a raw work by a teenage author. The sort of additions are somewhat incongruous stylistically. So we've chosen to use the original 1818 edition.
Mm-hmm. Again, This work has been, and I mean, Frankenstein has entered into pop culture. Most of us, our first experience of Frankenstein is through some outrageous Hollywood movie or television show. We confuse Frankenstein's, we confuse Victor Frankenstein with the monster, when in fact Victor Frankenstein creates the monster.
Right.
In this book, the monster actually has a female counterpart. And tell us about that.
Well, what the monster wants is to have his mate, as much as Adam
wanted his Eve.
Desired Eve. Mm-hmm. And basically he oversees, but through blackmail and violence. We shouldn't sort of start making the monster some sort of exonerated figure here, but basically forces through blackmail and violence Victor Frankenstein to create a mate for him. And at the last moment, Victor Frankenstein realizes that this could people the whole planet with this monstrous progeny, and he destroys the monster's mate, and in vengeance, the monster destroys Victor Frankenstein's mate, his wife Elizabeth, who is of course the innocent victim of this terrible mess that science has created. No, scientism has created, but we shouldn't blame science per se.
Is the monster a monster like a King Kong or Godzilla, or is this novel have a sense of the demonic?
Oh, it works on a spiritual level primarily. It works on the level of sin and usurping those things that rightfully belong to God alone. I mean, the whole point of calling the novel the modern Prometheus, and also quoting Milton's Adam as the epigraph at the beginning, makes it perfectly clear that the whole thing is meant to be working on a theological level. So he's not merely a monster in a materialistic sense, like King Kong. He's a monster in a demonic sense. And from the Latin word where we get monster from, means warning. So there's clearly a moral intention involved.
How did Mary Shelley regard this work later in life?
She basically knew that it was her best work. I think she was frustrated that none of her other works were ever as successful.
Uh-huh.
From our perspective, she's left us a legacy that for which we can be grateful, and something which, you know, has a timeless quality, as I said, because, you know, recently things like genetically modified foods were, in England particularly, were sort of headlines about Frankenstein food, and that was enough, you know. The two words Frankenstein foods spoke 1,000 words.
That's right. Exactly. Joseph, thank you so much, and I'm looking forward to next week. We'll talk about Hamlet.
I look forward to it. Thank you very much, Al.
Joseph Pierce is editor, general editor of the Ignatius Critical Editions. I recommend them to you. We've looked at Frankenstein today. These are tradition-oriented. This is they do literary criticism. They present the novel, and they, what you might call, a tradition-oriented criticism.
During this recession, many investors are afraid to invest in stocks or bonds. It may actually be a good time to invest, since prices are now low. At Ave Maria Mutual Funds, we believe our professional investment experts have positioned the portfolios to take advantage of the economic and market recovery we expect over the next few years. Now may be an opportune time to examine your portfolio and see if the Ave Maria Mutual Funds could help you achieve your goals. To learn more about the pro-life and pro-family Ave Maria Mutual Funds, the number is 1-866-AVE-MARIA to receive a free investor kit, or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Schwartz Investment Counsel, Inc., a registered investment advisor established in 1980, serves as an investment advisor. All mutual funds are subject to market risk, including possible loss of principal. To obtain performance through the most recent month-end and a prospectus, which includes objectives, risks, fees, expenses, and other information that you should read and consider carefully before investing, the number is 1-866-AVE-MARIA or at AveMariaFunds.com. Distributed by Ultimus Fund Distributors, LLC.
Great schools are places where ideas come alive and get everyone involved.
This is what Ave Maria University offers. Come and experience the fruits of a true liberal arts education at Ave Maria University. Unlike schools who take the faith for granted, the faith is the lifeblood of who we are. Ave Maria University, preparing students for success in this world and for never-ending joy in the next. Call 877-AVEU-NIV or click www.avemaria.edu.
The Catholic Mass is the most sacred act of worship in which a person can participate. At the Last Supper, Jesus Christ sat down with his chosen apostles and does something new, something never done before, and yet something which continues until the end of time. The Catholic Mass Revealed is a beautifully written, recorded, and film production. This collection will rekindle your heart, inspire your soul, and enlighten your mind. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and find the online store to get the Catholic Mass Revealed. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
I'm Al Cresta. Tonight on EWTN Live with Father Mitch Bakwa, he'll be inviting Monsignor Stanley Deptula to the program, Executive Director of the Archbishop Fulton Sheen Foundation. They'll talk about the cause for the beatification of Archbishop Fulton Sheen. And then let me remind you, that's EWTN television, and EWTN Global Catholic Radio will also be airing it. You can follow up on our conversation with Joseph Pierce today and Professor Rice and David DeFranco by going to AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net. Hit the Cresta Guest Archives. You can follow up. We'll have articles, essays posted there. Also, you can follow up on the books at AveMariaRadio.net in our online bookstore. I'll see you tomorrow.
Cresta in the Afternoon is produced and distributed by Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The executive producer is Nick Tom. The technical engineers are Kara Coulter and Anne-Marie Parisot. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMari. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.
Would you like a copy of this program? If you miss a part of this program or want to hear it again, Ave Maria programming can be made yours when you order. Just call 734-930-4506. Within a few weeks, you'll receive a copy of this show and any others you want to order on CD. Call 734-930-4506.
At birth, you bring your children into the Catholic faith.
I baptize you in the name of the Father and of the Son.
You nurture their faith as they grow.
Prayer is about an encounter with a living God.
Unfortunately, many young adults lose their faith in a secular, anything-goes college culture. At Franciscan University of Steubenville, your child's college years will be a time to grow in the Catholic faith. With its 40 majors and vibrant Catholic culture, Franciscan University is academically challenging and passionately Catholic. Find out more at franciscan.edu.
Cresta in the Afternoon is brought to you in part by Sienna, the Catholic mobile phone company. With Sienna, 5% of every voice plan goes to help the culture of life in America, over $1 million to date. Sienna uses the same nationwide digital networks as the big guys without contracts or termination fees. Flexible calling plans allow you to support a pro-life company and the culture of life with every call. To learn more, the toll-free number is 877-474-3662 or on the web at prolifecatholic.com.
Don't you agree that connecting with Catholics attracts like-minded consumers to your business? The Catholic Business Pages allows your business to have exposure among Catholic consumers and expands your opportunity as a business professional to get connected in your community. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Catholic Business Pages link. Get connected. Reach Catholic families. Take your business to the next level.
You're listening to Ave Maria Radio.